works?
I think so.
Okay.
We're rolling.
And I think that I remember now the name of a book I was telling you about by Jacques Attali. It's the Art of Noises, L'Art de Bruit, about this whole idea of this Western composer's making a new income through publishing their scores and allowing them to enter modernity.
Yeah, and how that changed their economic circumstances. Yeah, for sure. So then they were not in the specific employ of one person.
Yeah, but they were not depending upon one specific patron. And so you were saying that you didn't see, notice any form, similar form of modernist...
Musical thinking in India. No, I really didn't. And it's like experimental music has only really happened recently in India with the laptop, and it really seems mostly oriented towards beat music and sampling. There's some interesting field recording kind of stuff, but. And I think I said this a little bit last night in the movie, in that the sound environment in India is such that any approach to that would have... There's a serious research project, I think, in exactly that, like how to approach more modernist sound making, experimental composition, field recording even, in the context of India, because India is so loud compared to... other places. It's really hard to find a quiet space, at least in the cities, in the way the car horns are, and just in the way that most, even temple ceremonies that involve a lot of banging on bells, and no one seems to really care about answering their cell phone in the middle of whatever, you know, and even when you see a film, people are interacting with the screen more and yelling and, you know, talking and that kind of thing. Mm. So, it's... That would actually be quite an interesting research, I think, just, and even how that manifested in, say, America or, say, here, you know, it's pretty interesting.
But to get back to this parallel we were making with Western music tradition and this idea of the centuries spent by composers being under the spell or dependent upon a specific patron. Is there any also written tradition of musical of music in India, the way it has been the case in the Western world?
Not at all.
It's oral.
It's oral, and there isn't almost no way to actually accurately write. You can write the basic form of a raga, and if there's words, you can include that, and you can have the basic rhythmic cycle planned out, but for the most part, it's... there's so much improvisation in it that it's, and there's so much microtonal bending of notes and slides and textures that are important and almost impossible to notate.
So in a way, the emergence of this recording industry was like
a publishing thing. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And a way to put your stamp on a particular sound or a particular way of performing. And another thing that's hard to notate, and it's a big difference in Western music and Indian music, I think, is that in the West, there's more of the tradition of a composer doing something, and then a performer who realizes that. And in India, those are the lines are more blurred. There's, you know, because there's so much improvisation, you're taking a basic structure and making your own thing out of it. So the performers are composers in a way. And some are amazingly good at it, I think. And some are just more technical. They're just like very good at playing fast or showing off.
So there's no such a figure, even, in Indian music as the composer.
There are some famous composers that wrote melodies and stuff. But again, you would... those are always the starting point for how you interpret that. Though there are very famous composers who did things, but it's not quite the same as like your Beethoven.
Because it reminds me of a friend who was putting on a show couple of years ago, 3 years ago, of the two brothers from Egypt, oud players, and he was telling me that they were part of his new generation of musicians who were no longer only performing a specific tradition of oud music, but they were also composers, which was quite of a modern idea in Egypt among the young generation. I can't remember the name of the two brothers. I know that they grew up, they were born in Egypt, but they grew up in Australia, I think.
Because I feel like there's a lot of improvisation in that music as well, but I don't know enough about it to say anything intelligent. Yeah, and then there's in India also, there's a lot of people that have created ragas, which is just a specific melodic form with a attached emotional content and ideas. So they're kind of considered composers, but again, that's a starting off point to do your own thing.
And when it comes to using, you were saying that when they don't sing notes, they sometimes include poems in the... Were you talking about the ragas or all kinds of forms, of musical forms in Indian music?
All kinds of forms. There's a lot of composed lyrical music in India where the lyrics are very important and very specific about certain things. Oh, that brings me to a good point, though. But and then there's, in a lot of raga exposition, you might start with a few lines, and then you go off and improvise on the specific syllables. So you're not; it doesn't really matter what the words are after a certain point.
When they include poetry, do these poems come from a certain tradition, like old poets, or
yeah,
or do they also work with contemporary poets, or?
No, they're usually the, in my understanding, usually it's older forms of poems or that are specifically written to do something. In the Sufi tradition, for example, which actually even began as North Indian classical music, there's some very specific lines that you would say in the beginning of a song or as part of the song. And then also in the Hindu tradition, there's definitely lines about gods or relationships between the gods. A huge part of Indian music, the ghazals and tumris especially, are all focused around one particular thing, which is the relationship, the story of Krishna and his relationship to the milkmaids. Krishna's, this is why the hippies loved him, and why he's so popular is that he has very many forms and things that he's done, but his love story with Radha is very famous, and it's very, you can approach the same words, the same poetry about it. It can be very sexual in a very hidden way. It can be very love-oriented. It can be from her point of view, waiting for Krishna to come. So they have this, her feeling spurned by him, or whatever it is, they have this way of using these old stories in the religion to, you know, rather than writing about, oh, Maxime and so-and-so's love story, they would hide it in a story about Krishna and someone else, you know. So that's a huge thing, and India can draw so much inspiration lyrically from how complex the religion is. There's so many stories and there's so many different variations on the stories, and they can be applied in so many little different ways that the focus of so much of the poetry is basically on that.
So there's, once again, there's no such a form of as they would use these poems, these classical texts, as a vehicle for expressing personal views, or but there's no such a I myself.
There is, but art. There is, because some of those poems become personal. But you're almost, it's almost like you're saying I, but you're actually saying I as Radha waiting for Krishna or something. That's the underlying thing. But yeah, in terms of a personal development, there isn't that. Not in the same way that lyrics developed in the West, for sure, as I understand it.
And does it have to do with the place which is given to individuality, or how much individualistic Indian society is.
That's exactly it. It's not a very individualistic society. It's very family. It's very community oriented. I mean, as a lot of the world is compared to America, say, and probably France. And there's these universal themes that you can apply to your life, and people understand that better than, you know, you're not supposed to be an egotist and say it's all about me. You're supposed to sort of give yourself to the sublime. But I was just remembered. There was an interesting movie that I watched about, and I hope this is going to make actually be a worthwhile point to even make, but which was about one person tracing down in India a specific ghazal or a tumri, I can't remember, but the version that she knew that had become very popular and was sung by her teacher and stuff. This is a contemporary woman who had studied certain classical forms in India. The line in the song is about, it's like, you've wounded me. You've wounded me. And then there's other versions of the song that are less well known that are like, you've wounded my breast. And then other versions are like, it implies more like you've wounded my heart. But in some, it's like, you've wounded my breasts, implying more that, like, you've almost taken my virginity and wounded me that way. So there's, like, you can change one word and make it very, very different. And to go back to what we were saying outside, too, it was the recording of the one that's, you've wounded my heart, that's, you know, more normal, a little less sexual, that became very popular. But this other form existed. This other version of the song existed. So it's just in the way that particular artist approached this little bit of poetry that was used in the song, and then how recording said that, okay, that version became popular, and that's what people came to know it as. And then when this... I should try to remember the name of the film, but they went to various artists and were like, do you know this version? And they're like, no, that's not right. It's not that, it's this. But it actually is more complex, and I think that's pretty interesting.
And did you find recorded instances of this specific song, or you only heard about it through?
I read this in a movie, but okay. I know or watched it in a movie about. But I do have other versions of songs by the same artist that did the slightly more risque version, and other songs by the artist who did the more well-known version, and. I unfortunately don't speak the language, and there's a lot of languages. A lot of what Indian music draws from is Urdu, is Persian poetry, and I can't speak that, so I have to rely on what people tell me it means. And I'm not so interested in ultimately knowing it. I like just kind of hearing the sounds, and when the artist is good, he can make you understand that it's a song about yearning, and, you know, or something else.
But you were saying that you've based a certain expertise on identifying pretty easily the signature of one specific one. I would stop saying specific ten times. But you said you were able to identify like the sound signature of one performer, one musician.
Oh, certain things. Yeah, because of. Like Bismillah Khan, that's who we were talking about last night. He's just got his tone. I mean, people can do that with jazz music. Mm. Like, oh, that's Sonny Rollins. You can tell that right away compared to... You just have to listen to enough of it. And in India, in music, the instrumentalists, the vocalists and the instrumentalists train so hard to develop your tone. It's a hugely important part of it, you know, to develop your... signature, your little take on what you're being taught, because it's a school of music. You're studying very specifically with one person, but you have to make it your own in one tiny little way. And that's just, it's like with jazz, it's just time spent listening, you know, over and over.
So it's making, it's all about making an individual kind of expression through, by using... these
poems or these collective forms and source of inspiration. It's all about making your own.
Yeah, and it is, but it's like I said, it is also a collective community, and it is kind of at the same time as you are. At the same time as you're becoming a great artist and being able to be recognized through the tone of your voice or the tone of your instrument and how you use the musical material, the greatest Indian musicians will always be they'll always like give thanks to their guru, to their school of music that they come from, and try not to be an egotist about it. They're not like, this is my expression. I came from. Nowhere, and I created this. It's always, no, I am part of a tradition. I developed this from this, and they always give thanks for that. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing because India is so collective, and it is such a community oriented place. And so, you to carve out your little niche is very difficult and an interesting practice, I think.
And on an unrelated department, do you know how people like Pandi Pranath, we were talking about all these Indian musicians who have had an impact on Western music development. Mm-hmm. Do you know how people like him are perceived in India for what they've done for influencing or broadening the scope of their own culture abroad? Do they know anything about this or don't they care?
Yeah, some people do care.
Why him? Why was he picked up as being the one?
Yeah, because he hooked up with Ginsberg and all of this stuff. Well, and certainly, like with Ravi Shankar, there's a push and a pull with all of the India, with all of the my experience is just limited to old 78 RPM yeah. record collectors. First of all, that we need to say that out front. but a lot of people would say stuff like, Ravi Shankar was great in that he, went abroad and influenced all these people, but the real genius in the family was his brother, or something like that. They're very the people that I knew were very protective of their tradition and weren't so interested in what it might have influenced abroad, only in that maybe they had gone abroad, and isn't that cool that they'd gone abroad, but they didn't. They weren't very interested in, and this is something to do with collectors. It's like they were very focused on what they liked, and other stuff was very weird to them. So to answer, I guess I don't really know the answer to your question, except that they're very protective of their traditions, and they're not, obviously they love the Beatles for coming, but they were, it was like, what am I trying to say? It was like, to them, to these collectors, the Indian tradition is number one, and whatever else has happened or been influenced by that is below that, and they don't really care, in a way. And it's interesting that a white guy like me was coming to research music and to learn from them, and they liked to show that, but I try to talk about any kind of Western tradition, and they weren't very interested in it. Or to say that I was interested in certain aspects of Indian music, the drone aspect of it, or something, and they were like, yeah, that's great, but listen to this. Doesn't this break your heart? Yeah, it's great, but I'm interested in how it connects to me, and they're like, I don't care, listen to this. Eat some more chicken. So, that was, my whole take there was hanging out with these guys that were collectors that were very proud of their collections, and they wanted to play these highlights for me and stuff like that.
And the collectors that you've met are only 78 RPM collectors, or do they?
Oh, they have other stuff
like LPs also.
They collect LPs and tapes too, but I was really focusing on the 78s because I was interested in the earliest forms of recording and how that might have influenced other things. And so, yeah, that's who I just focused on. But they all collected everything, and they were all like into digitizing now in like the slowest, most ridiculous way, and putting all this noise reduction on stuff that just sounded horrible, but they liked doing that.
And you were saying earlier that your area of interest was 1902 up to 1925,
the acoustic era, as I say.
So 1925 is a shifting point in the history of recording industry?
Yes. Don't you know this kind of thing, Mike?
No, sir.
Why? Get out of my apartment! Wait, it's not my apartment.
So why 1925?
Have you ever heard of electricity? Do you know if you've heard of that?
Yes. I have.
In about 1925 is when the electrical microphone was introduced. And prior to that, all recording, you basically had a horn, a big horn, and you had to shout in it, and the that kind of focused the sound down to a little membrane, which then vibrated, and then that vibrating of that membrane vibrated a needle that would inscribe a groove in whatever material, but it was usually a wax master. And it's kind of a simplified explanation of it. But so volume was important. You had to be loud. You had to make sure the... It was very tricky in India because of the heat would affect the membrane. If you know what those early Victrolas and gramophones look like, it's like this round thing, and there would be a membrane over this with a needle coming down, basically. Like a drum head, stretched tight, and as it vibrated, it would make a needle vibrate. So it was somewhat of a imprecise way of recording sound. You couldn't get very good lows, you couldn't get very good high frequencies, and volume was very important. You couldn't get as much depth of sound. But some of the engineers could. It was a very idiosyncratic, personal, like some guys were very good at making it work right. And you also had, you know, just this one horn in front of you, and there'd be someone, because Indian musicians move their head a lot often, and there'd be someone like trying to keep you focused in front of that, and then move you out of the way when it was time for the violin solo, and then move you back. When an electric recording came in, it was much more sensitive, and so it really changed what could be recorded, and then it really developed from there. So it became much more sensitive, and that became very interesting too, because then you could record the much more delicate, quiet instruments. Sitars became even more prominent because they've got these really shimmering, sympathetic strings, they're called, and that got picked up much better. And finally, there had been plenty of instrumental recordings prior to 1925, and I think they're really like the most amazingly mysterious sounding things because they just sound so far away, and they're like getting lost in the surface noise of the record. There, I could play you some stuff, but they're so beautiful to me because they become so mysterious. They're just receding, you know. And with the invention of the electric microphone, it became much easier to. And the same thing happened in America, and that's when country blues really took off because you couldn't record a guitar very well prior to that, and then you could. And the other thing was that with electricity, the speed of the way the platter rotated became more set and constant, and you could also travel with stuff a little easier as long as you had the right batteries and stuff.
So the impact of the electricity on the recording of this music was not part of your interest field of study when you were in
India? It is. Personally, I was just a little more interested in the earliest stuff because it would, for me, that's when the changes began in how recording influenced how people perceive music and how people perceive sound. That's the only reason. And it's kind of an arbitrary thing, but I just needed to put a point at some point. Otherwise, it can go forever.
Yeah.
So. No, it's interesting. The beginnings of electricity, and you can hear it in the records too. You can really hear that suddenly something's changed in there.
And for how many years would they still release on 78 from 25 up to when are the first LPs?
Well, it's different all over the world, but in the West, basically, it was the 50s when vinyl. Late 40s, early 50s when vinyl started coming in, and they still made some 78s. There was a lot of stuff that was released both on 45 and 78. But throughout the 50s is when the LP, the long playing record, took off and became a huge thing. Maybe even by the early 50s is really when that happened. And in India it happened too, but much slower, and they actually manufactured 78s all the way up to the early 70s.
Wow.
In part because it was such a slow-moving country to have change, but also because so many people had the wind-up gramophones, and you can't play a vinyl record on one of those as it destroys it, but you can still play a shellac record. Also, India is where shellac is made, which is what the early records were made out of. And people didn't have electricity, so they had to keep making them. And then so it kind of slipped from 78s in almost straight into the cassettes. I mean, they were making vinyl throughout the 60s, obviously, for LPs and stuff, but 78s hung on there for a lot longer than elsewhere in the world. Yeah. Hey, can I have one of those? Oh, you're smoking Lucky Strikes, huh? Patterson Tobacco Company. Yeah. What else?
I don't know.
Why do we have to? We can talk about India. We can talk about other shit if you want.
We had an interesting conversation yesterday about Harry Smith.
Oh, yeah.
But it was really inspiring to me.
Have you listened much to the Anthology of American Folk Music?
I know it. I have it, of course, but I don't know it. It's not a... how do you call that?
A landmark for you or something? Yeah.
No. I know of its existence. I know it. I know how much influential it has been, specifically on people.
I mean, why would it be so influential to you? You're a fucking French guy, you know, and it's American folk music, but still. One of the things I think is so cool about it, and I think that's made it so, like, constantly relevant, is just how it's like one of the first and maybe greatest compilations of music. You know, it's like the way he put it together as a compilation is just really cool. And, you know, obviously, and think about it, back then there were no compilations, you know, because long playing records had only just happened. And the earliest things were maybe random collections of earlier music, 78s or whatever. But with the Anthology of American Folk Music, he involved all of this magic and alchemical principles that he was interested in, half of which are bullshit, half of which are just him spouting ideas because he was very learned, he's a very smart guy. But also, it works somehow. And the artwork that he included with it, with this hand coming down playing the celestial monochord, this whole idea of all this music comes from the same source, this whole way that he connected one ballad to the next ballad to the next ballad, to a blues song, to social music, the way he connected it all together was unique. I mean, and now people make great compilations that are interesting and themed, and of course our whole lives, if we've grown up, you know, we make tapes or CDRs for girlfriends or whatever, and, you know, we're very particular about how we put it together. But he was like one of the first people to really do that, to really think about how to put one song after the next in something and connect stuff. And the notes are they're so funny, the way he reduces the lyrics to these just a few lines, like, he's done research and he connects it back to what early ballad forms from England or wherever the song might have come from, but he doesn't make a big deal out of that. Like, too many liner notes in records, or, you know, they'll go on and on about it, and he just gives a reference, and then he breaks down the lyrics to the most important point. Like, some of them are so funny. He's got such a sense of humor, too. Like, there's a song, King Kong Kichi Kichi Kai Mio, which I don't know if you know it, but, you know, it's basically a take on Froggy Went Courting, and, you know, so it's a story about a frog being in love with a mouse, and then there's a fight because there's other people interested in the mouse or whatever the hell it is, and there's a big fight, and just the way he describes it about how mouse, I think he says mouse frog nuptials go awry or something like that. And it's just so, it's like a newspaper headline. It's really funny. So he did that. It was, and he did the liner notes himself, and made it like, it's almost like a fanzine and with these cutout images and little things that he found to put in there, and he typed it all up himself. So I think that's like a huge part of it. It's just a really, you know, when you start to think about the magical part of it, like, there's all these rumors that if you listen to it, the whole thing from start to finish, you know, your life will change or something will happen or the secrets of the universe will be revealed.
But I've never understood, for him to do this compilation, you were telling me that he had an enormous collection of records. So the sources, the recordings that he used to make this compilation were 78?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 78. It was all 78.
All 78.
And for him, coming off of what we were saying before, it was the beginning of the electric microphone. Basically 1927, 26 for him, up to 1932, which is when the Depression hit in America and really destroyed the recording industry for a while, really changed things. So for him, it was like, it was the beginning of electrical recording up to the other big landmark in music, which is
Depression.
The Depression and how that destroyed all these little labels and changed how people had to earn money and all of this stuff. So he kind of focused on that period. And also it was a time when a lot of American record labels were had no idea, and this was this something else I'm interested in terms of India, and they don't understand what makes a hit, they don't understand what people might want to listen to. And when you really get into music from this era, you can hear them trying to, like the record labels, they're trying to figure it out, you know. So, like in America, they started, well, maybe black people will buy records, and so we're going to go down there and record a bunch of black people, and we don't know who or what or why, we don't know. And so anyone could record, and that's what Paramount Records became so famous for. They recorded so many street musicians, anyone that could walk in off the street and record a song, they recorded them and put it out, and maybe someone will buy it. And a few people, it took off, and then they would make more records from that person. Nowadays, you know, it's totally different. Nowadays, there's much more, you know, grassroots, and you've got to establish a following, and you've got to do, you know, recording tests or whatever it is, and auditions, and blah, 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 blah. It's much more. But back then, they just didn't know. They just, let's go and record. Who can we record? You want to buy this? You're not going to buy it? All right, fine. We won't record him again. Fine. And that's, so he was really coming from an interest in that, and he, the other big thing for him was that in America and also in Europe, because of World War II, the shellac, which is what 78s were made from, which is an insect, it's an insect secretion, and you scrape it off these trees and you boil it down and it makes this stuff and it's used as furniture polish. But it also can solidify into a nice hard thing that can actually play, you know, have a needle bouncing on it. During World War II, all of the shellac trades were tightly controlled because of the war, because of the war at sea. Basically, it was very hard to import stuff. So many, many records were destroyed. They were brought back. They were brought in to be melted down, essentially, to reclaim the shellac for the war effort. I've never really found any direct references to, like, they used shellac to make guns, but I think it's more like because of how controlled the shipping lines were, there was a very limited supply of shellac, so the bigger record companies could control that, and the little ones couldn't, and they all went out of business, and so you couldn't just go out and record folk music anymore. You had to record patriotic songs. You had to do whatever the big labels wanted to do, so music, again, changed a lot at that point. And Harry Smith worked in, for a while, in a place that was reclaiming these old records. And he started to be like, I don't want to destroy this. This is great. And he started collecting, especially American country and folk music.
That's how he started accumulating records.
Yeah. He'd always been interested in sound, and he had his own record collection prior to that. But that's when it really took off for him. So some people say. Thank you. And then he went to New York, and he was broke. He's always broke, and he sold all his records to Moses Ash, and they put together this compilation. So, and he says great things. He's really, Harry Smith is really into patterns, and he was very interested in Native American, like, blankets, and into painted Ukrainian painted eggs, and into string games. You know, string games. You have a string in your head, like you do that when you're a kid. He's really interested in these patterns, and he was always looking for patterns in music, and how those repeated, and how, and that's a very alchemical thing too. When you start to, you know, you can have these formulas that might add up to, you know, in the, how you could turn lead into gold, or it might turn out, these patterns might tell you how to live your life better or understand the universe. And so he would say things like, he could look at a quilt made by an old American folk artist and, you know, understand her, what that person had come from and was about, as easily as if he listened to a song. And so he was always trying to look for these patterns between visual patterning and musical patterning.
That really interests me.
Yeah, and he says too, he said it specifically about Sarah Carter, from the Carter family. But he talks a lot about patterns, and he, you know, he says it's maybe easier if you can just look at a quilt, because you can take in a visual pattern in a second, but with a song, you actually have to listen to it for 3 minutes. And he was a painter, too. He did a lot of painting, and all the patterning is in his films, too, the way...
Yeah, I should remember now what he was doing with Jack Stern, if it was painting or drawings.
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah, I should double-check.
And taking a lot of speed, probably, too.
Did he have any interest in other musical forms than country music?
Harry Smith?
Yeah,
he collected everything. There's a... he loved records. And he, there's a great quote I read when he's got all these records, and he says, I don't even listen to them, but I just love having them, and I roll around in them every day. And he just liked to know that he had these records, and then he would sell them or lose them or whatever, or have to move to some other apartment and lose them. But he was very interested in music from all over the world.
But as you said yesterday, he never traveled.
He never traveled, yeah, no. As far as I know.
Yeah.
He was always too poor. So, he was very interested in American Indian stuff and hallucinogenic drugs and the patterning and all of that, and how, and the Indian peyote ceremonies influenced the music and all of that, too. So, he's an interesting guy. But he wasn't focused. And that makes him more interesting to some people, because he makes him more mysterious, because he didn't come out with any great final treatise on anything, you know, that you could read and say, okay, this makes perfect sense to me. He would just talk about these ideas that are really amazing and do weird artwork around it, or films, or whatever it was, and that makes it almost more intriguing. Like, what is the answer? And there isn't an answer.
Which, in a way, is the reason why I'm always tempted to connect him with Joseph Cornell. I have a hard time to pigeonhole him.
Mm-hmm.
Where is work coming from? His ideas, his films, his boxes.
And he was wasn't Cornell very isolated? Didn't he basically not go anywhere?
Yeah,
just did his thing?
I think he was having a day job in the post office or something. He was poor too. Living in New York and, yeah, taking care of his brother or...
Yeah, it's like the great tradition of American outsider artists.
Totally.
Yeah. And Harry Smith kind of fits into all of that. He's such an influence on people nowadays, like, more and more. I mean, we just played a show that was dedicated to it, and Mississippi Records just re-released the anthology. I mean, how many goddamn times can you re-release the anthology of American folk music? But it just still sells, you know?
Yeah.
So...
Do you have an original copy?
I have. It was originally done in three boxes, I think. Two records per box. And one was ballads, one was social music, and The last one is the basically the blues one. And I've got the first one, which is ballads, in the original. And I love having that. It's the church.